Well, we've just come off this Halloween holiday. Christians are often uneasy with Halloween and the days that surround it. They sometimes view these days as given over to the dark forces in the world, over to the devil, over to Satan. Well, we could debate Halloween, but what are we dealing with when we're looking at this religion, cult, movement, fad called Satanism? We're going to explore the ins and outs of Satanism and the various aspects of it, its various manifestations, here in the first hour of Issues Etc. Today. We are coming to you live this Wednesday. It's the 2nd of November. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our call-in number, if you have a question or a comment for our guest in the first hour, Dr. Richard Howe, as we talk about Satanism, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. That conversation will run about 40 minutes, and then we're going to spend the remainder of the first hour with Dr. Paul Grimm, talking about two days in the church, one that we missed and the other that we missed. Actually, yesterday or today? Commemoration of the Faithful Departed? Yes, All Saints we missed. Commemoration of the Faithful Departed. We're on that. We're going to talk about both of those days remembered in the church today. Dr. Paul Grimm will be our guest in the last 20 minutes of Issues, Etc. Then, in the second hour of the program, we're going to talk about a very significant event in recent history. If you were born after about 1960, you lived through a major milestone in church history. Vatican II. Now, you might not remember it, you might not know anything about it, but it was, in fact, the last major council, the last council of the Roman Catholic Church. What did Vatican II decide? Many say it was a breath of fresh air in the church, opening the windows and letting some fresh air in. What does that mean? And is the Roman Catholic Church in need of a Vatican III? We'll talk about that with Dr. Richard Warnock here in Studio A in the second hour of Issues, Etc. today. Dr. Richard Howe is our first guest. He received a Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of Arkansas. He's contributed to the book, To Everyone an Answer, A Case for the Christian Worldview. And he's author of the cover story in the latest Christian research journal titled Satanism, A Taste for the Dark Side. Dr. Howe, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
How are you doing? Nice to be here.
Doing very well. Most people, when they think of Satanism, have a kind of a horror movie picture in their mind of people dressed in black robes conducting black masses in the dark, Halloween, and all of those things. Let's start out with Halloween. Is Halloween somehow a sacred holiday to Satanists?
In a very important sense, it is, if for no other reason than Satanists would celebrate the motifs that Halloween traditionally brings to mind, motifs of death, darkness, black magic, ghouls, all of these sort of macabre kind of things. Now, they may have different reasons for wanting to celebrate that than perhaps other occult groups, but at the very least, I think Satanists chortle at the fact that our society has at least one day a year, a time when these things are brought to the forefront of their mind, and they think that's a good thing.
How would you describe Satanism as a phenomenon?
Well, there's a lot of different things going on under the name of Satanism. You can talk about Satanism as an official, quote-unquote, church, an official organization. You can talk about Satanism as a lifestyle that particularly teenagers are enamored with. And then you can talk about it in terms of at least a few decades ago at the forefront of the news was Satanism was in the news because of a lot of allegations about criminal activity. So all of these things are important dimensions of the topic, probably the most conspicuous of which is what I would call the religious Satanists, most exemplified by the Church of Satan.
Well, let's talk about the religious Satanists. You want to be careful in your article in the Christian Research Journal to distinguish between two branches, if you will, of the religious practice of Satanism. Tell about both of them.
Well, probably the person who's most single-handedly responsible for making Satanism a household word is Anton LaVey. He founded in the 60s the Church of Satan, and he wrote their manual of doctrine known as the Satanic Bible. And so that rapidly became the main representative of any kind of Satanism in any sort of religious sense. As far as I know, there wasn't anything that had as high a profile. And what LaVey, I think, did was a lot of people are probably would be surprised to know that the Church of Satan and Anton LaVey's style of Satanism, they don't even believe in the existence of Satan. They don't worship the devil in their sense. Now, we might as Christians say, well, ultimately what they're worshiping is the devil. But in terms of their understanding of themselves, they don't even believe that the devil exists. What he decided to do was take the symbolism and motifs that Christianity would ascribe evil to, the things that the Christian religion would condemn, self-indulgence, self-aggrandizement, pursuit of carnal pleasures. And since he wanted to celebrate those dimensions of the human experience as really being, quote, natural to us, there was no better symbol for that celebration of those things than the archenemy of Christianity, Satan himself. So what he decided to do was set up this church where he would teach people how to use the powers of the occult in order to basically advance their own agenda and seek their own carnal pleasures, and all with this motif of darkness and Satanism, precisely because he was celebrating things that traditionally the Christian church would have condemned and would have ascribed to the workings of the devil.
So in LaVey's branch of religious Satanism, Satan is a symbol, a nice foil for Christianity and its teachings.
Exactly. I mean, the 1960s were a period of a lot of cultural upheaval in our society. And so there was no better time, I think, for someone to come along and lampoon and, in effect, categorically reject the Christian religion in terms of its ubiquitous presence in American society. And so he thought that Christianity was fraught with hypocrisy because people would preach a certain lifestyle on Sunday morning, but they would live a different lifestyle on Saturday night. So what he wanted to do was say, well, let's just reverse it. Let's take what we live on Saturday night and, quote-unquote, preach it on Sunday morning. Because he thought that the tendencies to want to seek one's carnal pleasures, sensual pleasures, self-aggrandizement, and self-interest were just natural to us as human beings. So he thought, what better religion could you have than a religion that celebrates what already is natural to us?
Okay, so if the LaVey branch of religious Satanism, in effect, rejects the notion of a real Satan, a real devil,
yes,
what do they do with the notion of God?
Different Satanists may have different views. LaVey liked to do this with words. He would take words and sort of define them for his own purposes. So in a very strict sense, I would say that LaVey's form of Satanism is atheistic. And what I mean by that is that they don't believe in any kind of deity in any traditional Western sense of the term, as a being transcendent to the world who's responsible for the existence of the world, the way we as Christians would understand God. However, he sort of repudiates the notion of atheism in as much as he does celebrate what he calls this balancing force of nature, some type of energy or force, which, by the way, is what makes Satanism an occult religion. We might talk about that perhaps in a little bit. But nevertheless, this sort of balancing force that you can tap into to use for your own bidding, he likes to call that God. So in one sense, I'd say, okay, well, if that's what you mean by God, perhaps you're not atheistic. I would actually say that's more of a pantheistic notion than theistic. And in the traditional sense of the term theism, I think he's atheistic. So there is no God beyond just the self.
What about, you mentioned this already a couple of times, what about the occult aspects of this branch of religious Satanism?
Yeah, there is a very big sense in which Satanism bears a lot of affinity to other occult religions like witchcraft or paganism or these kind of things. Now, there are important distinctions in witches. Not only do witches not like to be associated with Satanism, but in many ways, Satanists don't like to be associated with witches. They don't like each other's sort of take on the world. But what makes them both occult is this notion that in reality, there's some type of energy or force into which someone can tap through various mind dynamics, ritual, heightened states of emotion, and that energy can be attenuated and aimed at some goal. Now, it'd be something like this. In his sequel to the Satanic Bible, titled The Satanic Rituals, LaVey sets forth a number of rituals that a person can undergo, many of which create heightened states of emotion, fear or anger or lust. And these heightened states of emotion supposedly act as like a generator or an antenna, if you will, for this energy. And then you take that energy, and the ritual helps focus that energy to whatever goal you have. Let's say you want someone to fall in love with you. You do this ritual, and this force will go out, and it'll affect that person and make them fall in love. Or you want someone to be met with an unfortunate accident so that you can get his job, or whatever it is. You've got a ritual for just about every kind of desire that you have. So it's that notion of the force that I have discovered in my research is common among all of these what we might call occult religions. Now, the things that make them different from each other, at least one important thing, is exactly what they say this force is. So for Anton LaVey, he sort of describes it in biological terms. It's sort of a bioenergy, probably not unlike adrenaline. Other occult religions may place this force outside of the self, like it's a nature force. Some may say it's extraterrestrial beings and are gods and goddesses or whatever. So they have different ways of personifying or describing this force. For LaVey, it's sort of this thing generated from within the human psyche through the use of ritual.
So is this whole system, both the force and the individual's ability to harness or channel or direct this force, is this what LaVey means when he refers to magic?
Yes. It is, because magic for him is going to be an attempt to manipulate your external circumstances by unconventional means. Now, what I take him to mean by unconventional is basically unscientific. That is to say, we don't have any problem with putting a pot of water on a stove and heating it up to a sufficient temperature in which it boils. And we understand these cause and effect relationships that exist in the material world. And so we call the art, if you will, of mastering these regularities of the physical world, we call that science. And we all celebrate science. We celebrate what it's been able to produce in us. But for LaVey, he thinks there's this sort of unconventional way of manipulating reality that sort of falls outside the purview of science and itself and the laws of science, electromagnetism or whatever. And this domain is more metaphysical, if you will. It's psychic. And so a lot of occultists would like to say that there's like a long tradition through several millennia of the secrets of how to manipulate this psychic realm. And this idea of secrets is really where the word occult comes from. It's from the Latin word for hidden or secret. And the idea is, well, supposedly there's been these secrets that only the initiates have been privy to, that have been condemned by the authorities, i.e. the Christian church. So it's driven underground. And it has to pass on its secrets through ritual and clandestine organizations in the history of Western thought. So he's sort of celebrating that. And in a word that's often used to talk about this art, besides the word occult, is magic.
We're talking with Dr. Richard Howe about Satanism here in the first hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We'll open up the phone lines for your questions and comments on Satanism, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Briefly, if you would, before we go on to the other kind of religious Satanism that there is, talk about what you call self-interested hedonism in LaVey's brand of Satanism.
Yeah, really, that's going to be sort of the point of the whole thing. Religions will often define themselves in terms of what they consider to be the summum bonum, the highest good, the ultimate reason for why we exist as human beings and why the religion, whatever religion it is, why it exists, how it supposedly is supposed to actualize this destiny in each human being. So for LaVey, his philosophy of life, if you will, can be described as a self-interested hedonism. Self-interested meaning that the ultimate focus of whatever it is I'm undergoing is something that ultimately should be in my own interest. The Satanist thinks it doesn't make any sense to sacrifice one's own interest in the interest of someone else. Now, they're not necessarily against working for the interest of someone else, but generally that's under the larger goal of something that works for my own interests as well. Sort of like if any of your listeners have studied political philosophy, to be sort of like Hobbes with the social contract, that I look out for your interest only in as much as your interests serve my interests. So it's self-interested in that respect. But then it's also a hedonism. Hedonism is just a fancy term for pleasure. And in the history of philosophy, you have different kinds of hedonism, at least two broad different kinds. One is a hedonism where you seek the pleasure or well-being of the greatest number of people, like John Stuart Mill would have been an example of that. And the other hedonism is a hedonism that's directed at oneself. So it's a self-interested hedonism. It's a philosophy of life that says the reason we live is to experience pleasure. And so what he thinks he's able to do in his Satanic Bible and the Satanic Rituals and other books that he's written is to help people understand how to maximize this pleasure, you know, how to grab all the gusto. LaVey doesn't believe in any kind of afterlife, so basically you only go around once in life, as the old advertising slogan used to be, so you need to grab all the gusto you can. And now, it isn't just this unbridled hedonism in the sense that, well, let's just go out and steal something from somebody because it makes me feel good, because he would do the calculus and say, well, you know, if I steal something, I may be put in jail, and then that wouldn't be in my interest. It certainly wouldn't be pleasurable. So I have to temper my pursuit of my own pleasure with a calculus as to what will maximize that pleasure over the long haul. And that all together makes this a philosophy of a self-interested hedonism.
All right, then out of LaVey's branch of religious Satanism grew the second kind, the Temple of Set. Tell us about its origins and how it differs from LaVey's Satanism.
Michael Aquino, who subsequently became the founder and leader of what is known as the Temple of Set, Michael Aquino was a close associate of Anton LaVey in the Church of Satan. He was a pretty high up. I think he's retired now, but he was a lieutenant colonel in the one of the branches of the military. He worked in intelligence. He was a very educated man, a PhD, and I believe in political science. But for various reasons, he became disgruntled with the direction that he thought the Church of Satan was taking. I think he was under the impression that too much of the way they were conducting things really served only Anton LaVey's interest and wasn't really room enough, if you will, at the top for both of us. So, as a result of his being sort of dissatisfied, disgruntled with the direction the Church of Satan was taking, he decided to consult the Prince of Darkness. Now, one of the key differences between what Michael Aquino goes on to do in the Temple of Set versus what had been going on in the Church of Satan was that Aquino apparently believed that there was a sentient being, a conscious being, that has in various mythologies been labeled as Satan or the devil, and then in Egyptian mythology was named Set, S-E-T. So he decided to do a ritual where he would conjure up this Prince of Darkness, if you will, to seek the Prince of Darkness guidance as to what do I need to do next. And so according to Aquino, he was instructed by Set to sever himself from the Church of Satan and sort of start this next phase, if you will, of Satanism. Well, of course, since the Church of Satan label had already been garnered and commanded by the Church of Satan, you had to pick a different motif. So he decided to name his church, if you will, after Set. And there's some interesting distinctions between the two, because Aquino's is a little bit less of a self-interested hedonism and quite a bit more of a philosophical mysticism, whereby a person seeks to, if you will, actualize his own divinity. One of the things I think that characterizes the Temple of Set, in fact, it makes it almost unique among religions in my research, is that many religions seek to enable a person to merge with the cosmos. A lot of your Eastern religions are this way, where you sort of merge back into some big cosmic unity. Hinduism, for example, would be that. Other religions, in the more Western tradition, are designed to somehow reconcile the individual human with ultimate reality without becoming that reality. So Judaism, Christianity, Islam, broadly speaking, would fall into that category, where the religion defines itself in terms of how to establish a broken relationship and estrangement that we have with the ultimate reality, that is God. And so you have these two broad categories. Well, what Aquino thought was, well, I neither want to merge with ultimate reality, nor do I want to reconcile myself to ultimate reality. I want to conduct my own being in the midst of all the other of reality. So they seek to sort of explore and celebrate a person's own uniqueness and how he interacts with all of reality without bowing a knee to any other being or without trying to absorb metaphysically with any other being. Just be your own God in the midst of a bunch of other gods. And it's a very complex array of philosophical teachings that you ascend up through these ranks to ultimately try to actualize that reality in your life.
Just in terms of raw numbers, pausing here at the end of our discussion on religious Satanism, before we go on to the others on the other side of the break, do we have any idea about how many people might be devotees of either Lavey's or of Antonin's type of Satanism?
Yeah, you know,
Satanism?
It sort of depends on who you ask. The numbers range anywhere from, you know, the low hundreds, if you ask some disgruntled ex-members, to the over 10,000 worldwide if you go by official church numbers. And I'm not sure how you can really, I don't know how they really designate who to include and who not to include, whether it's a role or if it's merely somebody who signed up for email over the internet. Arthur Lyons, who wrote a book a few decades ago as a research journalist on Satanism titled Satan Wants You, he estimated it as far back as the 70s to be about 5,000. I would suspect that in some meaningful sense it's less than that now if you don't include how easy it is to become a Satanist, quote-unquote, just by the Internet. I mean, anybody can jump on the Internet and be a member of anything and proclaim themselves a Satanist. So if you sort of factor that out in terms of just official numbers, I think it's somewhere in the median between the low 100s and the 10,000 or so.
Then with only 30 seconds here, Richard, why is it so important, before we go on to talk about these other brands of Satanism, to distinguish religious Satanism from kind of popularly practiced or cultic Satanism?
Well, one of the reasons would be how a person would approach them as Christians. What is our tactic, if you will, to try to reach them? Religious Satanists will probably be quite a bit more thoughtful in their philosophy, whereas some of these self-styled will be just a cloak for their own sin and rebellion against Christianity.
Dr. Richard Howe is our guest. We're talking about Satanism when we come back, about another 20 minutes or so with him. He is, he's contributed to the book, To Everyone an Answer, A Case for the Christian Worldview. He's author of the cover story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Satanism, A Taste for the Dark Side. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. About 10 or 15 more minutes with Dr. Howe on the other side of the break, and then Dr. Paul Grimm joins us from the Commission on Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to round off the first hour of Issues, Etc. We'll talk about All Saints' Day and the commemoration of the faithful departed. Today is the commemoration of the faithful departed. Yesterday, All Saints' Day. Long celebrated festivals in the church here. We'll find out what they're all about, especially following this Halloween holiday. And then in the second hour of the program, Vatican II will be our subject with Dr. Richard Warnick. I'm Todd Wilkins. Stay tuned.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you want to know what the Lutheran Reformation was really all about? There is a book that every son or daughter of the Lutheran Reformation must read. It's the Lutheran Confessions. They are the original confessions of the Lutheran Reformers. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November is called Concordia, a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions. It's $20.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for Concordia, a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions, Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for November. Rediscover the Reformation as you read Concordia, a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
The aftermath of hurricanes reminds us of suffering in third world countries. Today's Global Minute takes a closer look. Here's Action's Doug Nichols.
Ma'am, what if I told you that 35,000 children die every single day as a result of malnutrition or disease that could have easily been taken care of by maybe you or me? She said, how many? And I said, 35,000. She said, that's terrible. Somebody should do something about that. Have you ever heard that? Have you ever said that? Instead of saying, God, what should I do about it?
Many Christians have been shining testimonies in reaction to what they've seen and heard of the hurricane devastation. Pray those in third world countries, being largely out of sight, won't keep us from thinking, what can we do to show Christ's love and advance His kingdom? Hear more of what's happening in our world and how God can use you. Ask for the free CD, What Can I Do? It won't get you on a mailing list. 1-800-268-0461. 1-800-268-0461.
The Meyer Minute is underwritten by the North St. Louis County Chapter of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, including Lutheran Church of the Atonement on North New Florissant Road and Blessed Savior Lutheran Church on Shackelford Road.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Have the fall leaves been colorful where you live? In our backyard, we have what botanists call a euonymus elatus compactus. For us commoners, a burning bush. True to its name, its leaves have turned a brilliant red. The popular name comes from Exodus 3. The angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in flames of fire from within a bush. God said, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." A bush, and so much else we speed by every day. Wherever you look, nature offers countless opportunities to stand in awe at the magnificence of God's creation. Elizabeth Barrett Browning wrote, "Earth is crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. And only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit around and pluck blackberries." If you have only been plucking away at your schedule, you still have many opportunities for holy, marveling moments. Take a look, for example, at old Euonymus elatus compactus when it is bare. You will see that its branches are square, not round. So many opportunities to marvel, but what do we do? Rush on to the next meeting. Watch the next TV show. I'm Dale Meyer.
Issues, etc. is underwritten in part locally by Prince of Peace Lutheran Church in Crestwood. Prince of Peace is located at 8646 New Sappington Road in Crestwood. The Reverend Mark Smith is the pastor. Their phone number, 314-843-8448, or visit them on the web at popl.church.org. Prince of Peace Lutheran Church in Crestwood, an Issues Etc. underwriter on AM 850 KFUO. Believe it or not, I actually had a dream about this last night. I don't know what's going on. I am just, maybe I need a little time off because I do these plugs for these things in my sleep, and I dreamt that I was at the Image of God Bioethics Conference last night. I really, truly did. And for some reason, they made me one of the principal speakers. I'm not supposed to be. I'm just supposed to be broadcasting there and interviewing the speakers, but for some reason, it was one of those caught with your pants down dreams. Show up at school. There's a test you haven't studied, plus you're naked. It was one of those dreams. Really pleasant. Well, I expect that our experience at the Image of God Bioethics Conference coming up here on Friday, November the 11th, is going to be more pleasant than any dream I might have had last night, and interesting as well. We will be broadcasting live there from this St. Louis conference, the premier bioethics conference right here in St. Louis. For more information, you can go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, and you'll find the Image of God Bioethics Conference logo right there on our homepage. You can go hear Gil Mylander, Wesley Smith, and Nigel Cameron, Beverly Yonke, Gene Edward Veith, Dr. Robert Menton, Bob Weiss, James Lamb, lots and lots of Issues Etc. guests, and the very best in bioethics, Friday, November the 11th, here in St. Louis. Our website, issuesetc.org. Satanism is our topic for about the next 15 minutes. Dr. Richard Howe is our guest. Dr. Howe, let's talk about self-styled Satanism, and this is the one that keeps parents up at night worrying because a lot of young people are fascinated with the accoutrement, the paraphernalia of Satanism.
It's so much easier, too, these days with the Internet for young people to be exposed. I remember when I first started doing my research on Satanism, and I was doing it as a seminary student, how intimidating it was to have to go into a bookstore to actually buy a satanic Bible. You're hoping no one saw you doing that. Now, with the accessibility that the Internet gives, I can just only imagine that it's a geometric explosion of young people being exposed to Satanism with just a few clicks of the mouse. And rightfully so, it keeps a lot of parents up at night. I mean, I think we need to avoid two extremes when we're trying to deal with the phenomena of self-styled Satanism. And when I say that, I'm thinking mainly in terms of its effect on adolescents. On the one hand, I think we make a mistake if we dismiss the symptoms of young people being involved in the occult and Satanism. If we just dismiss that as just sort of adolescent whims and it's just a passing stage. I mean, it might be that, but we can't just assume that. On the other hand, we have, I think, need to avoid the extreme that we've had to deal with as Christians of just assuming that there's just such a vast satanic conspiracy that it's infiltrated virtually every level of society and it's bigger than God almost in terms of its power and ubiquity. So I see these two extremes. It's a phenomenon that we need to take seriously, but we need to do so soberly and sound-mindedly.
Is it most times, as far as you can tell, although there's a serious danger of slipping into something more serious, a dabbling of teenagers, young people, in just the periphery of Satanism or just in the look or the symbolism?
I think so. I think there's a certain allure just because we're fallen creatures. There's a darkness that's in our heart that will woo us, if you will, to the things of darkness. And I think young people, I mean, they're dealing with newfound passions anyway. Now they stumble on this sort of justification, if you will, of celebrating those desires, sexual or otherwise. And so it kind of gives them, in their mind, a justification. My experience has been that a lot of these young people, they're not really thoughtful in terms of, well, they take a satanic Bible and they analyze its philosophy of life and they have a worldview and they join an official organization. A lot of it is a sort of dabbling, if you will, just snippets here and there, or a certain way to dress in order to evoke some shock in your peers or whatever, and it gives you a sense of power and superiority, all the while sort of, again, lending credence to your natural tendencies anyway to pursue carnal pleasures.
Finally, let's talk about the what you call satanic cults, the yes and the no of satanic cults, the true and the false of it. I distinctly remember it was in the 70s seeing Mike Warnke on stage, huge crowd, and the story he told raised goosebumps and made you think there was a Satanist behind every rock in the head offices of every newspaper, in every state house. It was frightening. Was he telling the truth?
I had the same experience you did, and if you think hearing him on stage would raise the goosebumps, if you read his book, The Satan Seller, it told things that he wouldn't dare even try to address, I think, from the stage. The bottom line, the straight answer to your question is, I think, no, it was not true. That's not to say that there aren't criminal activity or there isn't criminal activity that may go on in the name of Satan. But I think there was a sense in which the society and Christians in particular were sort of duped by this hysteria of thinking there were these vast networks of Satanists who had infiltrated major corporations, government agencies, and even Christian churches in order to orchestrate this subversion of Western society and, you know, precipitate this satanic age or whatever. I think it was hysteria. In fact, not only in my judgment, based on the research that I have read, not only was Mike Warnke not telling the truth for the most part, but others who came along after him, Lauren Stratford, who wrote a book called Satan's Underground, claimed to be the victim of this ongoing satanic ritual abuse, what they call SRA in the literature, that she was somehow supposed to breed babies and these babies were used in these terrible rituals and things. it turned out that that wasn't true either. And interestingly, after she was exposed as fraudulent, she disappeared for a few years. All of a sudden, she reappeared with a new name and had another story about being a Holocaust survivor. So, you know, I don't know what their motives were. I don't know if these people were mentally ill or if they had some kind of ulterior motive of just marketing and trying to make money. Or maybe the whole thing was, you know, Satan was in that, in a sense, as a diversionary tactic to get us to. So, you know, we lose credibility, Todd, I think, if we're not careful in our analysis and we overreact. Then when something comes along and it really is real, nobody's going to listen to us because we've cried wolf.
Then finally, Dr. Howe, with only about 30 seconds, speak briefly about Christians reaching out to the Satanists.
Well, there's nothing wrong with the pursuit of pleasure. God has made us creatures that pursue pleasure. But it needs to be a pleasure that is dictated by God. And I would argue that ultimately our best interest and our pleasure is found in who God is. Taste and see that the Lord is good. So if we can get Satanists to see that, yeah, pursuing pleasure is natural, but your ultimate self-interest is knowing your Creator and being reconciled to Him based upon what Jesus has done for us on the cross.
So when someone says, look, is Satanism a problem? My first inclination is to say, well, of course it is, but it's really not the only problem, and it's maybe not even the worst problem.
Well,
that there is out there.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is we as human beings are fallen and we are estranged from God. That's the problem. Now, how that estrangement and rebellion against God manifests itself is endless, whether it's Satanism or whether it's something that's a little bit more socially acceptable. They all have the common theme of we are fallen human beings, we're estranged from our Creator, we're destined for an eternal separation from Him unless and until we are saved and are born again based upon what Jesus did for us. Jesus died to pay the penalty for our sins, and we need to have faith in what God did through His Son, Jesus Christ, in order to be reconciled. So in one sense, yeah, it's a problem, but it's just a particular instantiation of the biggest problem, namely our estrangement from God.
Dr. Richard Howe received a Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of Arkansas. He's a contributor to the book To Everyone an Answer, A Case for the Christian Worldview. And he's authored the cover story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Satanism, A Taste for the Dark Side. Dr. Howe, it's always a pleasure, and thank you for being our guest.
Thank you so much, Todd.
First stanza of that great hymn, sung often around this time of the year by Christians for all the saints. Dr. Paul Grimm joins us for the remainder of this first hour. We're going to talk about what the church celebrated yesterday, All Saints Day, and what the church celebrates today, the commemoration of the faithful departed. Dr. Paul Grimm is a regular guest, and he's executive director of the Commission on Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd.
These 2 days sit cheek and jowl in the church calendar. What's the difference between All Saints and commemoration of the faithful departed?
Well, it's kind of hard to sort that out in a quick fashion. If you look in the standard histories, especially for All Saints Day, you get about a whole page of different dates where the church over the course of this last 2,000 years has set aside a day to commemorate and give thanks to God for all those who have departed the faith. And November 1st eventually became the settled date for that festival of All Saints Day. There was also, though, already about the 12th century, another day set up, and it was to celebrate not those who are in heaven, but those who are in purgatory. And it became known as All Souls Day. And that was the more or less the distinction within the Roman Catholic Church that was followed with All Souls Day. And at the time of the Reformation, the Lutheran Church retained All Saints Day, but the All Souls Day they rejected. There have been, over the course of time, though, further adaptations and adjustments, and the commemoration of the faithful departed was also then sometimes added or included. Although, if for most practical purposes, the 2 days are collapsed into one, and together those 2 days, then we celebrate the feast of remembering all the saints of God who have departed this life and are now with Christ.
So, whether we look at it as the faithful departed or whether we look at it as All Saints Day, why celebrate this day, that is All Saints, or any individual saint day as a Christian in the church?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one I think a lot of people ask, and I think as people understand this, they find a great interest in it. If you go to Lutheran Confessions, and namely the Augsburg Confession, the first of our writings of the Lutheran Church, this question was addressed. It was very briefly addressed, but they bring up the question about the worship of saints, because that was a big issue at the time of the Reformation, that the saints were being worshipped, and the Church very much wanted to reject that. But in the Confessions, they do speak approvingly of the remembrance of the saints, and in fact, three reasons are given. It's very nicely laid out with first. It says the first is for purposes of thanksgiving. We thank God for showing examples of his mercy. And from these people who have died in the faith and are now with Christ, we do learn and see God's mercy so readily apparent as he carried them through this life and into the life of eternal life. He says then the second one is the second honor is the strengthening of our faith. And the Confessions give a very specific example. When we see Peter forgiven after his denial, we are encouraged to believe that grace does indeed abound more than sin. And so we can even look at the foibles, the weaknesses of those saints, and see that, you know, God indeed showed mercy to them, and that same mercy is also granted to us. And the third one then, and this is the one that some people might get nervous when they hear, but it's the third honor is that of imitation, first of their faith and then of their other virtues. But a very important statement then follows, which each person should imitate in accordance with his calling. And so, you know, if your calling is not to be one who is to be called, say, as a missionary to go to a foreign land, you don't just dump your family and say, oh, I'm now called to be a missionary. I'm going to imitate the faith of those great saints. But rather that within the stations in life which God has given us, we can learn from the examples of those who have gone before us so that we are strengthened to live that life that God has called us to live.
So it sounds like the substance of celebrating Saints' Days or All Saints' Day, the commemoration of the faithful departed, is in essence thanks to God for his mercy to them and to us, to the things he accomplished through them and through us, and then also as we would even with our living fellow saints, look to them and say, all right, in them we find an example to follow.
Exactly. And then the distinction you have between All Saints Day and all the other saints' days that we observe during the course of the year is that, you know, you have a festival observing the day of Saint Matthew or Peter and Paul, and you can go through all the apostles and some others. There we focus very specifically on their lives and their example. But on All Saints Day, it in a sense is sort of the grand take-them-all-in celebration and observance and thanks to God for all of these who have gone before us.
One of the things that I've always found fascinating is that Christ seems to, and I think the Scriptures seem to, regard those who have gone on in the faith, and usually in the New Testament, it's with reference to Old Testament saints, they seem to regard them as living. Yes, they're dead, but they're living in Christ.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, when you talk about any of the saints' days, or especially about this one, All Saints' Day, that we just celebrated, the important thing to remember, first of all, is about Jesus. It's not about us. It's not about Peter and Paul and whomever else. It's about Christ, in whom we all live and move and have our being. I mean, those who have died in the faith are with Christ, and likewise, we who live yet in this world, through baptism into Christ and through faith in Christ, we are also in Christ. And so together we are one in him.
Why do churches, in particular on the second day we're talking about here, the day celebrated today, the commemoration of the faithful departed, why is there often a practice of reading out the names of those who have passed away in the congregation in the previous year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a long history of that, and it actually that practice occurred at different times. Sometimes on New Year's Eve it was observed, sometimes the last Sunday of the church year as you're closing out a year in the church calendar. The purpose of that is simply perhaps to bring to mind to the congregation that these saints are not some very special people that are beyond our reach or knowledge or acquaintance, but indeed the very people in our own congregation who have died in the faith in that past year. And so that practice is simply to read their name, sometimes often done in conjunction with a Bible passage that speaks about the comfort and hope of the resurrection.
What are some cautions that the church in the past, and I'm thinking particularly what you mentioned about the Reformation and their very careful dealing with the issue of the saints and their place in the life of the church, what are some cautions to be practiced by the church past and present when it comes to these days, All Saints Day, and commemoration of the faithful departed?
The biggest concern I would have is the danger of losing sight of Jesus. And that can so easily happen when you start focusing on a particular person. And I mean, some people, I mean, there are all kinds of legends, for example, about the apostles and what they did after we no longer hear of them in the scriptures. But you can't finally sit there and spend all your time and energies focusing on those things of which we have no certainty. But simply, one, you know, rejoices that in Christ we have these examples that we follow. And in many ways, we follow them with the same anonymity that they have. We know very little about the life of any of the Lord's apostles, and that's probably as it should be. And we simply recognize that we are also part of that long line of believers from that stretch all the way back to those in the Old Testament who were waiting for that promise of the Savior that was given to them. And that focus must always then not be on us and on what our deeds are, what we do, but it's always on Jesus.
So it sounds as though it's exactly what Paul says, or what the writer of the Hebrews says, surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses. Our eyes are fixed not upon the witnesses, but where they're looking as well, upon Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith.
That's right. Totally so. And when one does that, you can then see these saints as those encouraging examples, whether it's Mary, who sits at the feet of Jesus to learn, you know, to take in the word that he's proclaiming, or whether it's Peter, who runs away, who hides, who denies his Lord, who rebukes his Lord at one point. I mean, in all those places we see, you know, both examples of faithfulness, and even in the midst of examples of unfaithfulness or doubt or timidity, we see, you know, that God's forgiveness covers all things, and indeed we can learn from that and grow through that.
What kind of abuses grew up in the church around what should have been the proper remembrance and celebration of the saints? What kind of abuses grew up in the church in the past?
Yeah. Well, to take the example that is familiar to many people, at the time of the Reformation, one of the things that had Luther quite upset was that the saints were basically worshipped. And not only, I mean, they would collect all kinds of relics, as they were called, whether it was fragments of bones that were supposedly from these saints, or a piece of the crown of thorns of our Lord, or his cross, the tooth of some saints, you know, just the list goes on and on. And there would actually be collections of these various relics around major religious centers in Europe. And Wittenberg, which was a rather small little town with a rather new university, had quite a large collection that Prince Frederick was very proud of, that he had been able to gather, no doubt at great expense, in order for the people to be able to view. And what they would then do is the faithful would come to view these relics and were promised that a certain number of years would be, you know, taken off of their time in purgatory, which of course was all based on a system of doubt. No one knew how long they were going to be in purgatory and how much they needed to do, or their relatives who would live after them who would need to do in terms of saying masses and whatever else to get them out of purgatory. So it was very much a works-oriented kind of a thinking. And it's interesting, you know, in some ways it probably had its origins far, far, far in the past. One of the things by which All Saints Day got started was in the Pantheon in Rome, which after the Roman Empire had fallen apart, the Pantheon was given to the Christians, and it was dedicated as a church, and in fact as a shrine to Mary and to all the saints. And legend has it that cartloads of bones of the deceased saints who had been buried in the catacombs in Rome were carried to this church where they were then interred. And so already there you have a sense, I mean, and there is a proper sense of understanding that, you know, that the body of the deceased is to be cared for with great respect. But it just only took a few leaps from there to come to this conclusion that, well, if somebody truly was very holy, then anything connected with him, whether it's a piece of their actual body, a bone or a tooth, or whether it's the cloth that Mary wore when she gave birth to Jesus, which is a famous relic in France, I mean, that these things somehow possessed a certain holiness that one could have transferred to their own account by just simply viewing them.
Paul, before we let you go, Concordia Publishing House and our issues, et cetera, the book of the month for November is Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. It's a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions, and I know you are familiar with it. Tell us about this book and why you appreciate this newly minted edition of the Lutheran Confessions.
I think that in every age, the opportunity exists for the members of the Lutheran Church to have a first-hand look at the confessions of our church, those writings that are foundational for the faith. And this is the first time with this edition, I think, that one could say you really have an edition that is intended for not just the pastor or the scholar, but for the average person in the congregation to be able to own, to read, to use, to refer to use as a devotional resource. I mean, the list goes on and on. Some of the nice features about this new edition are some of the historical backgrounds that are provided for the confessions, so that someone who has not perhaps studied the confessions much or at all can get a basic background and understanding to understand the time and the setting in which these were written and the purpose for which they're written. There's a very nice timeline that helps in that process. And just then the pictures, the full color photos that are provided are a great resource that you just can't find in any other book. And taken together, it provides a wonderful opportunity for God's people to have that faith which has been delivered to them confirmed, and as they for themselves study and learn what this great treasure is that we have and which we desire to preserve.
Folks, to order Concordia, a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions, Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for November, call 1-800-325-3040 any weekday during regular business hours, an hour to do so today. 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. On the homepage, you'll find Concordia, a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions. Dr. Paul Grimm is Executive Director of the Commission on Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Paul, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back from this break, hour two of Issues Etc. is ahead. We're going to be talking about Vatican II. Well, I was a little baby, when this happened. But it is a significant event in church history. A council always is. What was decided at Vatican II? What changed, if anything, at Vatican II? Why is it referred to as, well, an opening of the windows in the church so that some fresh air could blow through? And is the Roman Catholic Church in need of a Vatican III? We'll talk about it with Dr. Richard Warnick live here in Studio A when we come back. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.